Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, after the Sean Bell shooting indictments were announced on Monday, Police Commissioner Ray Kelly released a statement to the press. It wasn't the usual dodge about a few bad apples or an isolated incident or waiting to see what the evidence provides. Almost the opposite. Kelly said, quote, "Recognizing that the shooting death of an unarmed individual by police has exacerbated relations in the minority community, the police department will redouble its efforts to build the best possible relations with all of New York City's diverse communities through continued improvements in police training, recruitment, and community outreach," unquote. Well, if the commissioner is sincere about that, there are things he can do. A news analysis in the Times today says community leaders remain unhappy about what they see as the underlying issues of racial profiling and aggressive stop-and-frisk policies. Since the Bell shooting, the department has hired the RAND Corporation, as you may know, to evaluate stop-and-frisk procedures. And the Times article today quotes Kelly saying the department has to take a look inward and to use stop-and-frisk more judiciously and with greater sensitivity. So we thought this morning that we would take another step back from the details of the Bell shooting case and look at the state of police-community relations in the post-Giuliani era and now the post-Sean Bell era. What can the police do? What can the communities do if this goes both ways? With me first for this, and we'll talk later with Deputy Commissioner Paul Brown from the NYPD and others, but with me first for this is Richard Green, director of the Crown Heights Youth Collective, which serves primarily disadvantaged Black and Hasidic youth in Crown Heights. He also teaches history at Medgar Evers College. And, Richard Green, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. How are you today?
I'm okay. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Thank
you know,
you.
Before this incident, we had been hearing that police-community relations citywide were much better under Bloomberg than in the Giuliani era. But now there's a lot of talk about these underlying issues coming to the surface. Were problems being swept under the rug, do you think?
Well, you have to remember that this administration inherited a time period when policing changed into a whole new phase, and the incidents that took place under the last administration gave rise to a need to continue to improve. And the last administration did some things to begin that improvement, not only from the city level, but from on the national level. President Clinton made a very big drive towards it nationally, using both the Louima and the Giallo and the Dorisman cases as a springboard. And the next administration, of course, they inherited some of those changes. And the stop and frisk probably is one of the most obvious pieces that Commissioner Kelly has he inherited this new movement. But the whole idea is on a national level, the stop and frisk, as you know, came about way back in the 60s under the Terry v. Ohio, when police officers are allowed to do what is called a Terry stop or a Terry frisk. It's not a full-blown arrest. It's not a full-blown search, but it's where a police officer, using what they call reasonable suspicion, can take an individual over and actually pat them down. And what came in under that was a 250. Police department or a police officer has to do a 250, meaning has to report why that individual was stopped. And that's where we are today when that old piece came out in the city council hearings, whether or not the 250s were being done. And if they were being done, it was the culmination of those 250 reports being given back to the city council. And so that's where we're at this morning with that whole stop and frisk piece.
And we're going to open up the phones on this throughout this segment. Members of the community, members of the NYPD, anyone welcome to call in. What needs to be done to take Police Commissioner Kelly at his word and have the PD redouble its efforts to build the best possible relations with all of New York City's diverse communities through continued improvements in police training, recruitment, and community outreach, as the commissioner's statement put it. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Where should this go from here? And Richard Brown, Richard Green, what's your reaction to that statement that I just read from the commissioner on Monday? It sounds like he's acknowledging relations problems at very least.
Well, you know, I've worked with Commissioner Kelly now. This is the second watch he's on. As you know, prior he was with the Dinkins administration. And I'm going to tell you two things I found about working with Commissioner Kelly that I had personal dealings with. One, he came out to one of our high schools back in the 90s and spoke to an assembly. And some of the young people said to him, listen, Commissioner, we'd like to at least take the exam, but we don't have the funds to do so. Commissioner Kelly went out on his own and found some private sources that actually donated $125 money orders to young people in that community that wanted to take the exam. One of the young people who took that one of those $25 money orders is now a sergeant with the police department, a young man. Ironically, he came out of Queens, was one of my students when I taught at Brooklyn College. Second piece was when he was Undersecretary of State down in Washington, I got a call one day. The secretary said, hold for Secretary Kelly. He came on the phone to talk to me about the racial profiling that was taking place at airports for people coming in from certain islands. I don't know if you remember that issue about 10 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, right. He was working in the Clinton administration.
Right, exactly. So he called me one day, said, you know, I'm very concerned about folks being profiled allegedly by my customs agents coming in from certain islands. How can I work on that? And he really, we continued to communicate by phone how to ameliorate that condition, and it did work out that he, as a matter of fact, some of the Congressional Black Caucus even complimented mm-hmm. the way that he handled it.
All right, so you have long relations with Ray Kelly, and you think he's a man of good character who cares about these kinds of issues.
Absolutely.
But let's get more specific. Taking the commissioner at his word, mm-hmm. what do you think that general statement that I reread should mean in a concrete sense? Redoubling efforts to improve relations, carrying out stop and frisk in a sensitive way, in a more judicious way. Can you put meat on those bones from a community perspective?
One in particular, in terms of his beginning of his administration, talking about his three C's that he was going to work on: crime, counterterrorism, and community. Of course, we know after 9/11, the energies went towards counterterrorism, and of course, crime became a big issue. When he says redoubling, what I see happening now, as I read this statement, is that he's going to now take that same kind of impetus that he put on counterterrorism after 9/11. Sean Bell's incident was a very major incident in this city's history. So what has to happen now is that redoubling effort is what Commissioner Kelly and his administration is going to do to really make that third C work, where community issues are going to be raised, that young people are going to be engaged, not just on a stop and frisk, but we need to engage these young people in an education manner. We educate them, beginning even in the daycare, from the daycare centers, on the way up to the high schools, to get these young people understanding that if you take a survey and you ask an average young child, what does a police officer do? Arrest people. That's basically what they see. But there's trillions of other things that police officers do every day, but it doesn't show up in the box score because that's the perception that these young people have. So those are the kinds of things that I see, where the city mothers and fathers have to now put some actual physical efforts into bringing about some changes in terms of how young people perceive the cops, that they're not just, and if it's a stop and frisk attitude happening out on the street, that the police officers can explain to a young person, in essence, why they're being stopped and some of the things that they could now do as preventive measures to not be stopped again.
To explain it better to the individual, not just explain it on that form that they have to fill out.
Absolutely. I want to know, if I'm pulled over, which I have been pulled over, I'd like just for the officer to explain to me, well, I pulled you over because the model of your car fit the description of a car a model car that we're looking at an investigation. At least I'm not happy with being stopped, but at least I walk away feeling at least that I was given the respect to be give me an explanation. And the young people today, they are argumentative because they have much more latitude of knowledge of what's happening. And if they find that they're not being treated in a way, of course they're going to be reacting. And I think that what happened in Queens that night came out of that idea of fear and confidence, where these officers had a level of fear in them of what these young people were capable of, and it turned out to be that fear was completely unfounded. Had they not had that initial fear, I don't see that happening.
All right,
and
Richard,
the only way you're going to do that is to educate each other, both cops and community, as to what is really the reflections of what they're seeing out there.
Richard Green, director of the Crown Heights Youth Collective, with us here on WNYC, and also with us now, Deputy NYPD Commissioner for Public Information, Paul Brown. Commissioner Brown, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Good morning.
I'm going to read that statement that the commissioner put out and you put out on Monday after the indictments one more time and get you to tell me more about what it means, specifically the statement saying, recognizing that the shooting death of an unarmed individual by police has exacerbated relations in the minority community, the police department will redouble its efforts to build the best possible relations with all of New York City's diverse communities through continued improvements in police training, recruitment, and community outreach. Why did you choose that moment to say that to the public?
Well, I think the police commissioner, well, it's contained in exactly what he said. I think he felt, I mean, it was obvious after the Bell shooting that relations were exacerbated. And he was constrained somewhat while a grand jury was meeting as to what he could say. But I think in the area of community relations, it's just something he's felt strongly about. As Richard Green indicated, going back to his first tenure as police commissioner and also at U.S. Customs, he thought it was important to say and also important to do.
So when you say continued improvements in police training, recruitment, and community outreach, do you think those things have been deficient in some way?
Well, that would imply that they have improved and we want to do even better. One thing that's happened in the last 5 years, if you look at the police department, historically, predominantly white and with historic tensions in the black community, within the last 5 years, the uniformed-only portion of the police department moved from 65% white to 55% in 5 years. For an organization this big, 37,000 police officers, that's a huge improvement, and it didn't happen in diversity. It didn't happen accidentally. The commissioner saw with we're having a high number of retirements now because of the number of officers who were hired 20 years ago. There were a lot, and they retire, most retire after 20 years. So he saw on the horizon the opportunity to hire as many as 3,000 new officers a year, and directed our recruiters to use that opportunity in the last 5 years to increase a minority recruitment as much as possible. And that's worked. And I think that's one underlying improvement. And we still have those opportunities in years coming to improve it even further.
Right. Well, let me go then to the quotes of the commissioner in the Times News Analysis today, where he said the department has to take a look inward and use that phrase, and to use stop and frisk more judiciously and with greater sensitivity. And again, he used those phrases. So do you think it hasn't been used with enough sensitivity or judiciously enough? And put some meat on those bones.
Well, I think Richard also alluded to this. When you have officers, particularly if it's a busy night, and they may have, a general description of somebody, and they're stopping, say an armed robbery has just happened, and they're stopped. 10 people have been stopped who generally fit the description, but there was only one perpetrator. Well, obviously, you're stopping 9 people who were not the person, and there has to be an acknowledgement or an awareness in that. In the concern that this may be, in fact, the armed person, there may not be the sensitivity that an innocent person would expect. So I think reinforcing those notions and reminding officers who have the authority to stop individuals, which at best is an inconvenience. You're on your way to an important, you're picking up your kid somewhere, a babysitter is waiting, something like that, and you're stopped and you don't have the time to be stopped and you haven't done anything wrong. That obviously agitates people, understandably so. And the more officers are trained to be cognizant of that, while at the same time having to protect themselves from the actual individual they're looking for is a balancing act. And I think the police commissioner recognizes we have to do all we can, that the balance on the side of sensitivity is as strong as possible.
Richard Green, do you want to react to any of that?
Well, you know, I think Paul has made mention of two things with the fact of the sensitivity piece. And you can't legislate sensitivity. I remember speaking to some officers once out in Queens, and they said to me, my mother taught me CPR. You can't actually teach somebody that piece. It comes with the territory. If one is now being told by their sergeants or their lieutenants or captains that when you stop that young person out on the street, because he fits the description because he's wearing a uniform of the day, you know, dungarees, a New York Yankee cap, and a T-shirt, if you stop that young person and that young person walks away from that engagement feeling at least that, not necessarily an apology, but an apology would be great, but if not an apology, at least an explanation. And I think that's what Commissioner Kelly and his staff is saying now, that we have to look at how we're going to really put that CPR and implement it, where when that disengagement takes place, that young person feels that they have at least not been violated. And, of course, the other side of it, that the officers do their duty part by doing that 250, that at least it's there, that it's not something that's being hidden. The fact that the commissioner came out and gave these numbers, it's the fact that he wants to increase the level of transparency.
The 250 is the form where they write down the reasons for the stop.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, but before you go, Commissioner Brown and Richard Green, I want to get your take on this, too, from the community level. Police-community relations does have two pieces, police and community.
Yes.
And Commissioner Brown, what do you think the community's responsibility is in police-community relations, and does that need to be improved?
Well, it's obviously a partnership. I think when you have it's not helpful when sometimes people want to equate, say, an accidental shooting to a murder, or if there's a kind of a denial about the problems of guns on the street. You know, on one of your last shows, I've heard people, you know, talk about the problem of out-of-state supply, which is, in fact, a big problem, and concern that guns may be being sold in bodegas, which we would follow any lead on that. But the fact also remains that we have a lot of young men carrying guns. This last week alone, and other weapons, we've had several police officers seriously wounded and almost killed, and two auxiliary police officers killed because the people they encountered were armed. And that's a fact of life, and it can't, and I think the community, responsible community members recognize that and support us. And I think all of their efforts in helping us get these guns out of the hands of mainly, not exclusively, but mainly young males would be is essential for our partnership.
Richard Brown, is it fair to put, I'm sorry, Richard Green.
That's okay. Colors get mixed up.
Too many colors. Is it fair to put part of the onus on the community when we're talking about the police with all their power? It's not an equal relationship,
well,
is
no,
it?
Well, no, we have a part to play. If they're New York's finest, we're New York's dearest. I think we have a part to play in this whole picture. You're talking about 38,000 cops and 8 million New Yorkers. We have a part to play. As I said earlier, the city mothers and fathers in from the leadership level have to set something in tone. But on the community level, I think Commissioner Brown indicates that we do have the reality of weapons in the community. We have other issues happening in the community that have to be addressed. And we're doing as best as we can. I know we've been doing it for the last 30 years, attempting to keep our young people out of harm's way, attempting to show them how to move down the street. And it's a reality. If I tell my young person, if you have to carry ID, you can't be looking in a way if you're walking in a certain area, I will tell them how to posture to avoid them from being thrown on the wall. And if it does happen that they are on the go on the wall, I have to now educate them how not to escalate that condition to walk away with a charge, how not to how to de-escalate it by just cooperating and moving along. These are things that the community, from the clergy and others, have to do. Teach our young people now how to move in this environment. I mean, if there's a, if we're asking on one hand, we're asking for the reduction in crime, and then at that same tone, we're asking them to not be as aggressive. We have to help to create a balance. And I think the balance can be created by those folks out there in the listening audience who have young people that are going out every day, what they should carry, how they should move. I tell my 18-year-old son how to move on the street. I point things out to him that has to be done. And I, and my daughter's driving, I point certain things out to her if she's driving, what's going to happen. So these are things that all of us can do. And we, and those are little things that sometimes we may think are not important, but they end up becoming very important. And you don't volunteer. You have our young people not volunteering to become the victim. They can't just walk out there and expect that the police officer who's been given a call over his radio or her radio that there's something happening out there, that they're not going to react to it. And I think Sean Bell, the Sean Bell incident is a good opportunity. Out of this crisis is a great opportunity for us as a city to learn, and that this young man's life and death was not in vain, that it's something that we could all now grow and become a better and reflect on it as we move through this whole idea of community building and community relations.
Deputy Commissioner Brown, anything you want to say before you go in addition?
Well, just that if we had a Richard Green in every precinct, I think we'd have not only a safer city, but a much more unified one. I think I'd subscribe to every word he just said.
Deputy Commissioner of the NYPD, Paul Brown, thank you very much for coming on with us. And we'll continue in a minute with Richard Green, director of the Crown Heights Youth Collective. We'll start to take your phone calls, and we'll bring on another community activist as we continue to talk about police-community relations after the Sean Bell case indictments. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and a quick reminder that we take requests. You can email us with issues you'd like to hear debated or topics you'd like to hear explained. Send your requests to Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC.org. Put the word requests in the subject line. We continue to talk about police-community relations after the Sean Bell incident with Richard Green, chief executive of the Crown Heights Youth Collective, an organization that provides services for disadvantaged youth among African-American and Hasidic communities in Crown Heights. He's also an adjunct professor of history at Medgar Evers College. And we're going to get to Eddie Ellis, another community activist in Brooklyn, in just a minute. But our lines are hopping, so let's hear what some of you have to say at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Jean in Washington Heights here on WNYC. Hi, Jean.
Hi. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I've heard a couple of discussions of this issue in the last couple of days, and specifically in response to the question that you asked about the statement that the department made. Mm-hmm. A couple of people made very specific suggestions. For example, they said there's some concrete policy changes that need to be made, one having to do with the internal culture of the police department, because it really doesn't matter what color the cops are. They have been trained and internalized the culture of that department, so there has to be a real overhaul of that internal culture, and that leadership has to come from the top in making those changes. And another specific thing that was said was that there's a lot of over-policing in the city. In other words, there are situations that could be resolved without intervention by the police. For example, in the club where Sean Bell and his friends had been partying, if there are questions about the club, about its license, about, you know, incidents happening in the club, that maybe that is a situation where something short of policing itself could be followed. In other words, the licenses of the club could be suspended, you know, with or some kind of action could
right.
be taken that would not have to involve
right.
the police.
Now, of course, the police would probably say that the creation of the club enforcement unit followed on the murder of Emet Sangiyan, and I think there was another murder affiliated with a club scene, and so they started to send undercover cops in to more places to try to find those small violations, prostitution, drugs, maybe not so small, guns, even less small, that they suspected, you know, might have been present at Club Kahlua, for example. And, of course, we see that it we see what it resulted in this case. But, Richard Green, what do you think? Maybe that's a case of over-policing to solve a relatively small problem.
No, well, you know, it was definitely a judgment call, and those cops who went in that evening and started that. I mean, not the club piece. I'm looking at what took place outside of the club. That was a judgment call. Sometimes the officer on the scene will have to make, as the caller says, have to make a decision whether or not that was something. Here it was an engagement party, the time of the night. All of those things were factors those officers had to take into consideration. Apparently, and as we reflect, hindsight being 20/20, they made the wrong moves in how they carried that out. But they did it to the best of what their training knowledge was at that moment. Would we as city want them to have engaged these young people if, in fact, there was a weapon? Would we have wanted them not to engage them? That would have been a judgment call that those cops would have to make. And it's very difficult for anyone to kind of, even police officers that watched that whole thing go down that I've spoken to after the incident, some may have said, no, I would have probably not engaged. But again, they're doing a club operation, as the caller says. Maybe it was something that the state liquor authority might have taken into consideration or whatever, if that was an incident happening at the clubs or things happening there that had to be done. And another part of that is to how, for the future, how do we look at where do we put police officers in a situation? Do we put them to investigate in that kind of a scenario? Do we keep them maybe outside and look at things happening from the outside level? So,
also joining us now is Eddie Ellis. And, Gene, thank you for your call. Eddie Ellis is Executive Director of the Center for New Leadership on Urban Solutions at Medgar Evers College, where Richard Green also teaches. So maybe you two know each other.
Yes, we do.
We do it. I know of his great work.
And Eddie Ellis was last here. Some of you may remember to talk about his mapping and determination of the prison inmates in New York State and how few neighborhoods, most of them in New York City, all of them in New York City, such an overwhelming percentage come from. But Eddie Ellis, what do you think about the question of police-community relations and the question the last caller brought up of over-policing?
Well, I think that the question of over-policing, I think, I think that the last caller really identified a major part of the problem, and I think that is the organizational culture of the police department and the way in which members of the police department react with regard to that culture. And part of that organizational culture, from my perspective as a black man who lives in the inner city, is that there is an almost acceptance within the police department, particularly within the ranks, that it is permissible to be disrespectful and to carry on aggressive policing in communities that are in abject poverty and communities of color.
So did you happen to hear Paul Brown when he was on a few minutes before you? I think if there's any news coming out of this discussion, it might be that Brown said that the police department will try to do a better job of communicating to each individual who is stopped and possibly frisked the reason for that. You know, maybe they look like a suspect that they're looking for, or maybe they had a bulge in their jacket that looks like it might be a gun, or whatever it is. Do you think that's an important step if they take it?
Well, I think that's a small first step, but I think that what really needs to happen is that police officers, two things need to happen. One thing is that police officers need to know that when you go into communities of color, yeah, no matter how aggressive your policing is, you can't be disrespectful. You can't mistreat people. It doesn't happen in the white community. Only happens in Latino and black and poor communities. And secondly, from my perspective at least, more importantly, there has to be a way in which police police officers who do commit misconduct or disrespect are disciplined. Now, it may not seem like a big deal to disrespect somebody on the street in the course of aggressive policing, but when it's multiplied 38,000 times, 365 times a day, it becomes a serious issue.
And it becomes a relations problem.
It's so serious is because there are no disciplinary sanctions for a police officer that disrespects people or mistreats people or abuses his or her power.
It's not in the disciplinary interdepartmental or departmental code. Lisa in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
Yeah, I just wanted to say this much that I see, because I do a lot of traveling around the country and out of the country. I truly believe that it's the mindset in which policemen of all colors train to look at people of color, period, as potential criminals.
Yes.
I'm an old lady, and they stop me periodically because I drive a van. I guess they think I got bums in it. I don't know. But they never give you a reason. They just stop you.
Would it make a difference to you if they did give you a reason, since that's what's come up?
Well, it would help me to be able to understand better than you just stopping and telling me I got to search your van, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm trying to say?
Right. And what about...
Then they come on you very aggressively. And I said to the man one day, I said, officer, and I was trained to always say officer to a policeman because I'm originally from the South, and they train us a little different than up here. But we never approached a policeman and say cop or any disrespectful man. It was always used the term officer. So it's embedded in me to say that. And I said to one officer just recently, as a matter of fact, about 2 weeks ago, I said, officer, what is the search for? Why do you have to search my van? What is the problem? And I drive a big van, by the way. It's really big. I guess it does look suspicious. But the point is...
We're going to have to get you on our next global warming segment.
What was that?
We're going to have to get you on our next global warming segment. But never mind.
So anyway, he looked at me and told me to shut the F up. And I said, jeez, just like that. I said, my God, I'm old enough to be your mother, because he was a younger cop. Okay, I says, I'm old enough to be your mother. I says, why would you speak to me like that when I think I have a right to ask you why you're searching me or want to search my vehicle? And he repeated the process, and then another officer that was standing nearby in the immediate area, he came over, and even he got uglier. And I just kind of like looked at him, and I was so in awe that one of the policemen, I assume he must have been a boss over them, he said to them, you know, he gave some kind of hand signal to them, like, in other words, let her go, leave her alone, or something to that effect.
Right, well, at least that happened, but I guess that's the kind of story that you know, that a lot of people could call and tell, because we've had a lot of calls over the years of people telling stories like that.
And you know, I was recently in the South, and I was looking at a small town newspaper, and ironically, their front page story was how this city managers were now going to rein in how the police officers stopped and approach people, because on the other side of the Terry stop, Terry frisk, there's what's called a Wren stop, where a police officer can actually pull you over for a broken taillight and go through a full-blown search of your vehicle. And that's actually was confirmed with the U.S. Supreme Court. And a lot of police officers will pull you over and, as the caller says, will carry you through a search procedure for vehicle if the vehicle is, quote-unquote, suspicious, out-of-state license plates, things of that nature. It's things that they will go after. But, and the other piece I think that Eddie Ellis spoke about a moment ago was the fact that once that's done, how you engage that individual. I worked on the national policing group a few years ago, and we were talking to chiefs all over the country how to go through what we call the approach, the assessment, the arrest, and the last A was the apology, that most police officers are not being deemed, as the caller said, to make that apology, and that goes a long way, especially if you're dealing with an elder being pulled over on the road, or just anybody for that matter.
Eddie Ellis, the last word.
I think that the real import of that last caller's statement was the fact that the police were abusive. They used profane language. They were disrespectful, and they mistreated her when they didn't have to do that. And, you know, from her perspective and my perspective, there needs to be some disciplinary sanctions. And I think that, you know, we're focusing in on the Sean Bell incident, but we got to keep in mind the historical perspective, announce when there'll be another Sean Bell. Until and unless we're able to inculcate into the organizational culture of the police that you cannot go into minority communities, poor communities, and disrespect people.
Well, interesting that, the NYPD has come out with these statements saying they need to redouble their efforts to build the best possible relations with all of New York City's diverse communities, that they need to take a new look inward, to use stop and frisk more judiciously and with greater sensitivity. So here we've had
a great application of disciplinary sanction for people who break the law, who are police officers.
So a little piece of that conversation that, of course, is ongoing. Eddie Ellis from Edgar Evers, Richard Green from Edgar Evers and the Crown Heights Youth Collective. Thank you both very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Peace.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, two guys with Down syndrome who wrote a book about their lives and the high expectations that they have for themselves. Stay with us.